has joined the court, so we're all here, and Mr. Sipple, you may proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Chief Justice Havocat. Good morning. Mark Sipple, along with Eric Henry, co-counsel for the appellant, Eric Henry. In this case, after a six-day jury trial, Mr. Henry was found guilty of felony murder, use of a deadly weapon to commit a felony, criminal conspiracy to commit a robbery. He was sentenced by the trial court to life in prison plus 50 to 70 years. We will split the argument between myself and co-counsel. I will argue primarily assignments of error relating to destruction of the body, what I call a 29-19-13 argument, and assignment of error relating the allowance by the trial court of Exhibits 84 and 86, compilations of text messages to go to the jury.
So you're going to take 10 minutes.
Pardon?
You're going to take 10 minutes.
I'm going to take 10 minutes, yes, Your Honor. If I have time, I may touch on the jury instruction argument only if I have time. With respect to the destruction of the body, the victim in this case, 13 years ago in State versus Davlin, Judge Girard, writing for a majority court, this court, discussed 29-19-13. And he discussed what the purpose was of it, what the effects were of it. And he said that it was to level the playing field when evidence is unavailable and prevent the prosecuting authority from making use of evidence that was not available to the defense. The most significant piece of evidence, forensic evidence in this case, was the remains of the body of Steve Jorgensen. And they were never available to the defense. Not at any time were those remains available. There was no forensic evidence in this case that tied the appellant to this crime. There was no DNA, no fingerprints, footprints, hair, fiber, nothing. The most important piece of forensic evidence in this case was the body.
Well, counsel, do you dispute the cause of death?
Well, we don't know. It would be hard to dispute it, but I don't know. We don't know. Your Honor.
Was it, what, did you have an expert pathologist assigned to you or appointed?
We applied for and talked to a pathologist. But what, he couldn't help us because the body was gone.
Well, but what would, if you had the body, what would you be looking for?
Well, here's some things we'd be looking for. A co-defendant, Kim Henderson, testified that she stabbed Mr. Jorgensen in the neck. When the body was found, there was a knife protruding from his neck. Not much doubt that it was a homicide. However, there could be doubt as to whether or not that wound caused his death, as opposed to...
Does that make any difference?
Well, it might make a difference.
Well, this is felony murder.
It was felony murder.
So if he's correct there and even doesn't even touch the guy, he's still felony murder.
Might have made a difference to the jury. It's a fact that certainly would have been discussed at trial and argued at trial. Henderson also testified that Quentin Kreitzer, another co-defendant, hit Mr. Jorgensen in the head with brass knuckles. Kreitzer was a big guy, 50 times. That would have been an issue. Did the pathologist for the state didn't find that those injuries caused his death? That could have been disagreed. He had significant quantities of methamphetamine in his system. And the pathologist for the state acknowledged on cross-examination that his method of determining the amount of meth in his system was not the best method to do that. Maybe another pathologist would have used a different method, better methods, and determined that he had life threatening
amounts.
Well, again,
what difference does that make to your client?
Well, if he died because of an overdose of methamphetamine, that would make a significant difference to our client. The point is, the point of this assignment of error is that there's a statute, and the statute doesn't say, well, let's examine what difference the preservation of the evidence would have made. The statute says, don't destroy the evidence, and if you do destroy the evidence, there's going to be some sanctions for that. And the statute's very clear. And this court has discussed that statute in two significant cases, State versus Broderick, and that was a tablet case.
Assuming that the statute prevents the admission of that evidence, is that harmless error? If not, why?
I don't think it could be harmless error. I don't think there is any scenario that you could develop that would be harmless error. If the most important piece of evidence that the state has, important to the defense maybe, is destroyed, I don't know how that could be harmless. And the statute, is clear. It is not.
But was the cause of death an issue in the case?
I think a lot of things are at issue.
Well, I mean, the two eyewitnesses to the crime said that after Hendry stabbed him, he died, and he's dead when they left, and they testified that he was stabbed numerous times and beaten in the head with the brass knuckles. He was alive at one point in time, and then they beat him so badly he became incoherent. They were trying to get his PIN number for his savings account, and at that point they decided to kill him, and when they left, he was dead.
All of that is true, Your Honor. I think that the record bears all of that out. But the statute doesn't allow for that. The statute, in our view, doesn't allow for that analysis unless the analysis is a harmless error analysis. Yeah. That's the only way that it could be.
Your position is an autopsy is a scientific test, and they prevented you from having a scientific test of your own, and therefore, under the particular statute, the evidence is not admissible.
Yeah, and it's our position
how long,
because it's pretty clear. That's what the statute says.
How long would the state have to keep a body?
I don't know, and that's a question I anticipated, and I don't know the answer to that. But I suspect that rules could be developed, and of course, there are those cases where the body is never found and the state proceeds with the prosecution for homicide without a body. If they choose to destroy the body, then maybe that's the way they proceed.
Was the time of death crucial here?
I think there were time problems, but I don't think the time of death is crucial from the standpoint of whether or not the appellant was present. I think we all understand when approximately the death occurred. The answer is no. I don't think that was crucial. But excuse me.
How do you respond to the state's argument that the statute doesn't apply to a body, that it only applies to firearms, ballistics, fingerprints,
well,
etc.?
This court didn't decide that in Broderick. Broderick involved a tablet. It didn't involve ballistics or firearms identification or those things. Davlin, that argument, I don't know if that argument was made in Davlin, but Davlin involved the destruction of a larynx in an arson case, and we know what Judge Girard said and what this court said about that. And so I think the state's reading of the statute, keep in mind they cite no case that supports that, is a strained reading that makes no sense. Of course, the statute applies to all evidence, including a body, if there were scientific tests and analysis, which there were.
Changing the subject, what about exhibits 84 and 86?
84 and 86 were important exhibits for the state, and this is the way they look. You'll see them in the record. They were objected to. They were put into the record. They were marked and received as evidence through phone technicians, people who do phone dumps and so on. These are compilation of text messages.
You argue that there wasn't any foundation for these documents.
Well, Mr. Klugman will touch on that. What I want to touch on is why they went to the jury room and why they shouldn't have went to the jury room. On their face, it's substantive evidence. Substantive evidence, arguably, of the appellant's guilt. That gives the court the right to put them into the jury room. But what happened with these exhibits was interesting at court, somewhat insidious, and changed them from being substantive to testimonial. These exhibits were put on something like that. We called it an Elmo during the trial. It was something to show to the jury. And the Elmo was put right up in front of the jury box, and these messages were magnified so the jury could read every one of them. And likely they did, because every one of the messages was discussed with Mr. Kreitzer, a co-defendant, by the state's attorney. They went through every message. They went through every message, and he testified about every message. And he testified as to who sent the message.
That wasn't transcribed and sent to the jury, was it?
They heard it. It was oral testimony under oath.
But then they have to rely on their memory as to what he said about these. But the substantive evidence went to the jury in the form of those exhibits.
Yeah.
You're saying it's not substantive anymore, it's testimonial.
Right, that's what I'm saying. It turned into testimonial because he testified as to who sent them, and because they were in kind of what I call prison slang, he testified as to their meaning. And he testified. He testified orally under oath. 25-1204 says that's testimonial evidence. And the court has no discretion.
They didn't transcribe that testimony.
Well, they're transcribed there on 84 and 86, which the jury read, and which Kreitzer testified.
You're not arguing that those aren't complete statements or complete context of the evidence taken off the phones. It just had the redacted part that didn't have anything to do with the crime.
Well, I'll let Mr. Klugman argue about the completeness, because I think there is an argument there.
Okay.
But they were testimonial evidence, and the court had no discretion to allow testimonial evidence to go to the jury. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Klugman, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please support Mr. Sippel introduced me as Mr. Klugman. I was co-counsel for the defendant in this meeting case.
We're going to give you 10 minutes, even though Mr. Sippel went into your time a little bit.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Your Honor. I would ask also if there's any remaining time that be reserved for rebuttal in this case. I see the court's a lot of questions for Mr. Sippel are probably focusing on my issue in this case.
Are you arguing instructions?
I'm arguing that I'm handling the admissibility of the text messages.
Okay.
Kind of a new technology. I know Mr. Sippel is something new to him, but I'm familiar with those text messages.
So you concede that you could have offered Exhibit 83 and 90 to the jury as substantive evidence.
Well, Your Honor, I will address that. In the transcript of this case, I objected to all 83, 84, 85, and 86 at that time. Also, after the court accepted in the evidence or was in the process of it, I did make the comment on the record that if anything should go to the jury or anything be entered into evidence, it would be 83. What 83 was a complete phone dump of what we call the Vanessa Benson phone.
It's a disc.
It is a disc. And also, it was a printout that the printout wasn't offered, but the disc was offered. It is a complete compilation of all text messages between Vanessa Benson's phone and this post office phone that was found.
To and from.
Yes.
And then 84 and 86 were simply the messages to and from that particular phone that related to it.
It gets confusing, yes, that's correct. 84, as Mr. Sippel pointed out, was a yellow and blue copy, which was from Vanessa Benson's phone to this post office phone or his other phone.
Yeah, 83 and 90 would have had other phone calls that she made to other people and everything else on there.
83 would have included text messages.
Her text messages.
From her to other people, from other people using her phone, to other phones, and possibly 890.
Not relevant to the crime.
No, may not be relevant to the crime. However, those additional messages would show, section 86 also, that other people were using those phones besides the alleged defendant
those are the two that just purportedly deal with the calls from Henry to Benson's phone and from Benson's phone to the post office phone.
I would say that the post office phone, the problem we have with the post office phone, since the court brought that to our attention, that came in this case, as this court has previously ruled, is the new technology. And very few cases in front of this court, as to this issue, is the post office phone wasn't found on a person. There are no records as to that number ever written evidence. Whose name was assigned to that account? Nothing to that phone. In fact, the one thing we do have about the post office phone was from the state's witness, Stacey Loveless. Ms. Loveless did call the last number on that phone under the name of Cowboy. Ms. Loveless testified that a gentleman answered the phone and said, "This is my phone." Well, at the time that phone was, I believe that call was made, Mr. Henry was already in custody for number one. Number two, this gentleman by the name of Cowboy admitted that it was his actual phone. So that's one of the issues that we're going to go into. The state also put in evidence these text messages with the testimony only of Ms. Benson and the two police technicians. It was admitted into evidence, it was made on the record, that the two technicians themselves did dumps just on the phone that was in our possession.
Foundation for these calls. The foundation was these are calls that we pulled off these text messages that we pulled off these phones. We aren't saying who they came from, we're not saying who sent them. We're just saying these are the text messages we took off Benson's phone and the post office phone.
Yes.
Anything wrong with that?
Well, the problem that comes along with that is that Ms. Benson testified at one point, yes, these are some text messages from my phone. If I remember correctly, and I could be wrong, the record also showed that Ms. Benson testified as to some of the messages on those phones. What we don't have in this case, as with Elsman, prior case before this court, Ms. Benson didn't even know the defendant's phone number.
Well, did Krister testify that he used Benson's phone?
Yes, but that's where our issue...
Did he identify the post office phone as the phone being Henry's phone from which Henry sent him text messages?
Well, the co-defendant, Quentin Kreitzer, yes, he did identify, but that was after all these messages were even put in the evidence.
What's the significance of that?
Well, the significance of that is that when the phones went into evidence in this case, is that the foundation for the people who were introducing the evidence, there was none. All they knew is that there was these two numbers calling back and forth. There was no corroboration. It wasn't done until after it had been argued. It was argued to the court without the jury present. So at the time they were putting it might have been a timing issue. At the time they were putting the evidence, there was no foundation. Possibly, maybe, after Kreitzer testified, possibly.
Can you later in the trial lay the foundation and establish the basis for the text messages? Does that make the original admission of the text messages error?
Possibly.
Was it more truly a relevance foundation?
It could be a relevance foundation. However, I would draw this court...
That's a pretty weak objection, isn't it?
It can be, but I would draw the court's attention to something that hasn't been brought in front of this court, and I know the court has reviewed all the briefs, is something called text spoofing. We had the state's witnesses agree that you can do it.
That goes to weight, doesn't it? Not to whether or not the credibility of it, but not to admissibility.
It could. Under 901, you have to... Whatever you're offering, it purports what it has to be. However, there's a possibility these text messages aren't what they're to be. They're from a different phone number. They're from a different phone. They were changing, manipulating that number within the system through this application.
Well, wasn't Henry identified as a user by Krister based upon his language and his use and Krister's familiarity with the way Henry spoke and the language that was used
And wasn't that differentiated, and wasn't Krister's text differentiated from Benson because Benson used correct English and spelled correctly, and Krister didn't do all of that?
Some of that came through.
And he identified what his text messages were and to whom he thought he was sending.
To whom he thought he was sending them to. Also, Kreitzer, or Kreitzer, however you want to pronounce it, I'm horrible at last names myself, also testified that other people used these phones. Henderson, co-defendant, had used that same phone, allegedly, that number. He had used that number. Cowboy had used that number. There was multiple people had used that number. Kreitzer's own self-serving testimony that it was just Henry and Henry only that used that phone, there's more than that there.
The jury heard that.
Lots of people
use this phone. Here's what's on the phone.
There was testimony as to that through Mr. Kreitzer, yes. On top of that, with all these exhibits and text messages and all the issues with that, we had some issues as to 27-1006 summaries. Through the state's own admission on the record, these were summaries of the text messages that went allegedly between these two phones.
Not really. Were they? Weren't these all the messages that were allegedly sent by Kreitzer and Henry, and that the other messages that were left off were messages from Benson to other people or something else that wasn't relevant to the case?
Well, it was relevant.
But they weren't. These aren't summaries. These are actual statements made on the text messages. Nobody's summarizing those.
No one summarized them, but they took certain messages out.
They left certain messages out. Well, wouldn't you argue that if those messages had nothing to do with the case, that those would be hearsay or not relevant?
Well, I wouldn't say they had nothing to do with the case.
Well, what would the other messages have added to the case for the defendant?
Well, it would show that other people had used that phone.
That wasn't disputed, was it?
It wasn't disputed. However, it made portray those two charts made portray that those were the only two phones they talked back and forth. I see I'm out of time at this time, and I just ask the court, based on the brief submitted and the assignments of error on this, raised before this court, we'd state that the defendant did not receive a fair trial and ask that the case should be reversed and remanded for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. Good morning.
Please, the court. James D. Smith, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee of the state of Nebraska.
Mr. Smith, if you could, unless you're going to reach it, you seem to argue that an autopsy is not a scientific test and not subject to this rule. Is that your position, that this is not a scientific test and therefore it's not subject to this particular rule if the evidence has been destroyed?
That would be one of my four arguments on that point.
I'll just proceed then.
Okay. I wanted to first address Mr. Sipple's argument on the not having the body and the effect of that. The defense argument I would submit is that there is a duty on the prosecution under the discovery statute to preserve and maintain bodies, dead bodies, after autopsies. I would submit there is no such duty under the law. I would cite...
Where do you think the preservation of a body wouldn't comply or wouldn't fall under this particular law?
Well, if I could, I would cite there is a California case that I would cite. It's not in the brief, apology, but I did find it afterwards. It's People v. Vick. It's 11 California App 3rd, 1058. And the court there said there's a clear distinction between examination of physical evidence such as handwriting exemplars, fingerprints, written statements, and the body of a human being. The former are susceptible to examination without likelihood of outrage to the emotional feelings of the living, as reflected in our laws. Our society extends more respect to a dead body than to other physical evidence. I think the statute can be construed in a similar vein that the legislature, when they said scientific tests or analysis, and they put specific items there, that they're treating a human body as something more than just a mere piece of physical evidence that you just keep on the shelf forever after the person's already been victimized. We're going to victimize their body one more time by just treating it as a piece of physical evidence. Well, the legislature could have said that, but they didn't. They didn't use that term. They just used the term scientific test.
Well, didn't we reach a particular body part in Davlin, which was the larynx, that wasn't available, and therefore our determination was that it was to exclude the use of the tests on the larynx rather than the entire autopsy because the larynx wasn't available? Isn't that a scientific test?
You read the case closely.
Trying to.
The holding of the case is the objection was not preserved. Therefore, and then the court goes into some, or Judge Girard does some dictum there, and I guess it goes back to something I heard Judge Hendry once say, are you going to make us swallow our dictum? That, frankly, is dictum, that part of the analysis, and ultimately Judge Girard reached the conclusion there's no discovery violation anyhow because the larynx, the objection, I believe, was to exclude the entire testimony of the pathologist, and that what they're really talking about is the evidence of a specific
body. But that would, by some implication, indicate that we thought an autopsy would be a scientific test.
That, if you take the dictum, yeah.
You could imply it. Okay.
I don't think the argument was really made. It was.
Is the cause of death an issue in this case?
No.
Why not?
Cause of death to me is not an issue because it was the person killed in the perpetration of a felony. You have the other two accomplices testifying to the stabbing of the victim who's alive, he's struggling, person stabbed, they testify he's dead, Kreitzer and Henderson. When they leave the scene, we have the defendant admitting to Corey Condrey that he went and killed. So we got a third witness. He admitted that he went and killed, stabbed the victim. And then when the police go to the scene, when they do find the body, we have the further verification that the body is essentially where the people who were there said it was. It's in the kitchen. He's dead. He's been stabbed. So I would submit that the cause of death, if they hadn't had any pathologist testify at all, makes no difference in this case. Was the victim killed in the perpetration of a felony? Yes, he was.
Would it
guilty.
Be incumbent upon the defendant to allege what he would have been able to establish had he had the body there to perform a second autopsy on?
That would be my second argument, Your Honor, that the district court didn't commit an abuse of discretion by allowing the pathologist's testimony in, and that's because the defense did not show a discovery violation. The statute talks about evidence necessary to allow the defense to conduct like tests or analysis with its own experts. You can't perform two autopsies on one body. What you can do is preserve what you have done in performing an autopsy and make that available to the defense.
Well, in a sense, you can perform two autopsies. You can have someone else come in and do their own independent autopsy on the body and examine all the tissues that's there and examine the body and make their own determinations. My point is, what would they have said if they did that?
Well, that's my point, is the defense had a pathologist. They acknowledged that what the prosecution provided, which was the pathologist's lab report, the wound chart, the photographs, the specimens, that those were all made available. The defense had an expert, provided those, and acknowledged they provided what was provided by the prosecution to their expert witness, and they presented absolutely nothing to say that that expert was unable to conduct an analysis of what was provided. And I would submit under the statute, when it's talking about such evidence necessary to allow the defendant to conduct light tests, they did not show that what was provided was insufficient for the defense pathologist to be able to essentially analyze it to reach a conclusion on cause of death. And if I could, I would refer specifically to Judge Steinke's ruling. It's on page 364 of the Bill of Exception. And the judge says he'd reviewed the statute and given the entirety of the record, including the fact that all autopsy results, photos, tissue samples have been made available to the expert of the defense, and the evidence been received, the facts, the opinion of Dr. Bowen, that the decedent or his opinion will be died of multiple stab wounds, the court cannot find a violation, cites the statute, that would justify the court preventing the state from offering the testimony of its pathologist. The defense has got a pathologist. If what they were provided was not sufficient to allow them, that pathologist, to reach an opinion as far as cause of death, I would submit it's
they should have raised that issue then.
What's that?
They should have raised that issue.
They should have raised it. They should have presented something to show a discovery violation rather than their argument is just we got to have the entire body or else we can't possibly do an analysis.
Well, following up on your comments, Mr. Smith, if you have a homicide and the question is strangulation and the larynx is destroyed and the defense wants to determine whether or not there was a strangulation, what would your position be on that?
I guess it's going to involve the context of the case, but I think that's a more difficult case because if they come in and say, what we have been provided, they bring in the pathologist and says, what I have been provided is insufficient for me to be able to reach a conclusion on cause of death because I really need that. And if I have that, I might be able to say this, that, or the other thing. And if they showed that, I think that's a more, it's not this case, but I think it's a more difficult case if that had happened.
But is that larynx part of, is that a test on something other than ballistics, et cetera, et cetera?
Depends on what you're going to do with it. If it's a scientific test, there's a difference between looking at something and rendering an opinion and actually performing a scientific test on that thing. And the statute says scientific test. I think it's also important in the record, the testimony of Dr. Bowen.
Before you move on, I want to be clear on that. You are distinguishing, the statute says scientific test, and you're saying a scientific examination is not a scientific test.
Yes.
Thank you.
The toxicology report, if you take blood and you test it, that's a scientific test. But an examination of the body, I would submit by itself, is not a scientific test.
What about the admission of exhibits, I think in particular 84 and 86, that were the phone text messages from, alleged phone text messages from Kritzer and Henry using Benson's phone and using the post office phone?
Before I go switch gears and get into that, could I finish the point on? Okay. I would ask the court to review the testimony of Dr. Bowen. It starts at page 370 of the Bill of Exceptions. And what he testifies is he performed a medical legal autopsy. And he explains it's an autopsy like any other autopsy, but we preserve the evidence. We take photographs. We make documentation. We prepare a report of our findings. And then he goes into photographs, wound chart, documentation of his findings. So what he explains is a medical legal autopsy isn't just some other autopsy. It's an autopsy in which the pathologist is preserving the evidence, and you preserve the evidence for situations in which if there's issues as far as cause of death, you've preserved it so others can look at it, like the defense pathologist who apparently didn't seem to have any problem because they didn't put the person or present any evidence from him that he had was insufficient. Dr. Bowen's testimony, as far as the only scientific test he performed, was on the decomposition body fluid, and then he reaches his conclusion. But to me, there's a difference between just an autopsy and what Dr. Bowen describes as a medical legal autopsy, which is an autopsy in which you are documenting everything you're doing, you're preserving. I think in those cases, I think a medical legal autopsy pathologist is going to say if there's things that you need to preserve, you preserve it, larynx. And in this case, what he did preserve and what he documented, I think supported his opinions on the cause of death, and I would respectfully submit is sufficient that another pathologist could look at that and have what is necessary to determine whether that cause of death, whether he agreed or disagreed.
Wouldn't have to look at the punctures of the heart or the lungs or that sort of thing in order to make a determination.
You photograph that, you take it, so you can see it. Final 2 points on the body would be the discovery order that they filed by on a supplemental transcript shall provide discovery, and it says as set forth, and then it cites the statutes. 1914 is one of those statutes, and 1914 specifically provides that a discovery order pursuant to 1913 shall be limited to the items or information in possession, control, or custody of the state. At the time the discovery's order is entered, they don't have the body, it's been cremated. So if you look at that statute strictly, which they want to make that argument, strictly 1914, that discovery order was limited to what the state had in its possession, and it didn't have anything else at that time. Final argument I would make is harmless error, which I think we discussed already. As far as the text messages, this is essentially the new era of criminal evidence in which we seem to have crimes committed by people that don't have jobs, but they all have cell phones, and they're all texting each other. And I think what you're seeing is more and more cases in which cell phones and the text messages are now the critical evidence of the day. And I would submit what really ultimately convicted Mr. Henry, in addition to the testimony of all the other witnesses, was there's no way he could walk away from those cell phone messages and the contents once they're admitted into evidence.
Did Pritzker identify those messages that he sent to whom he, to Henry, or whom he believed was Henry?
Well, this one's even more incredible than that. We have two cell phones, one I call the post office phone, the other one is Benson's phone. And we have Kreitzer is testifying from the text messages that he recalls the messages, he identifies the messages where he's calling, he's getting, or he's texting, and he's getting the response from Henry. And he also testifies that when Henry would send him a message on Benson's phone, he had programmed into his phone a big E so he would know that was from Henry. And so he testifies, just from his testimony, he identifies the text messages on Benson's phone that are between him and Henry.
Okay, so you got the foundation, at least what you claim you have foundation. Then exhibits 84 and 86 are actually published to the jury.
They're actually published to the jury and taken to the jury room.
Because they're substantive evidence?
Because they're substantive evidence.
Even though Kreitzer testifies to the content of those messages. But his actual courtroom testimony wasn't transcribed and given to
the jury. The actual witness testimony from the witness stand is not transcribed, not go to the jury. The text messages, the exhibits, go to the jury. Kreitzer, Benson identify, they explain those, their foundational testimony, their explanation, what these mean. But
are any of these messages hearsay?
The only one that I would submit could possibly be considered hearsay would be the messages that Benson and Kreitzer testify that are between them, not the defendant. And that, frankly, I would submit is admissible for context when you look at those few that are between Benson and Kreitzer, and I can give you an example. When they first meet in Lincoln, that's what I would call start of the conspiracy. Henry goes to Lincoln, picks up Kreitzer, has Henderson with him. They're at Benson's place. And at that time, up to that time, Kreitzer is using Benson's phone. When they leave to go to Columbus, Kreitzer leaves Benson's phone with Benson. And then what happens is he then is using, Kreitzer is using the post office phone. He's using Henry's phone. And so he is identifying from the text messages, this text message from Benson's phone to the post office phone is actually Benson to me, me to Benson, which although it's hearsay in the context, it explains, helps for foundation, it helps to identify who's using what.
Is it offered to prove the truth of anything in particular?
It's not offered truth of anything other than essentially they're having these conversations.
What's the most certain evidence that messages said to be sent by Henry were sent by Henry?
The best evidence of that I would submit is Kreitzer's testimony by identifying the messages that he's having back and forth with Henry, that he's identifying them as being Henry.
But they're coming in as E?
Well, that's...
Which is the identifier for incoming messages from
Eric
a
Henry.
Certain number.
They're coming
I mean,
in
it doesn't,
on this...
doesn't necessarily say that it was dialed by Henry.
No, it comes in as he comes from that phone, and essentially what Kreitzer says is, I know how he talks, essentially in the context of what communication they've had. For example, he's getting phone messages from E about coming to Lincoln to pick him up. He comes to Lincoln, he shows up. So, I mean, what he's saying is, the communications that they're having after that in the context of the surrounding events are in the nature of the events in which they're both together also.
But that's the highest degree of certitude, that these are statements by defendant.
It's evidence that shows they purport to be what they are. And also, for example, after Henry has dropped off Kreitzer, Henry gets a message that he believes is from Henry, or Kreitzer gets a message he believes is from Henry about I left my keys with him. He did leave his keys with him, needs to pick up the keys. I mean, things like that in the context of the events are what I would almost call self-authenticating, because they're verifying the events that are going on that they're talking about as they're taking place. And at least the foundation, Five Brief, has six pages, pages 30 to 36 of foundation on those two cell phones. It's fairly extensive, but I think it meets the test of that those text messages are what they prefer to be. Messages between Henry and Kreitzer on the two phones. Unless the court has additional questions, we pass the judgment.
Thank you. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal, so we will go on to the next case of the day, which is Captain versus State. I am accused from this matter. Judge Reitman from the Court of Appeals will come forward and sit with the court, and Justice Wright will preside. So, Judge Moore will remain with the court and sit also, so you'll have a full panel of seven individuals. So give me a moment to get out of the courtroom and Judge Reitman to get you into the courtroom. And then Judge Wright.